Hey guys, welcome to the Dark Light Podcast. I'm Joe.
I'm Jen.
And we are bringing you with part three of Richard Marquis-Montes. But, so we are going to do four parts, but we have it all written down. We are going to record it back to back for you guys, so don't you worry. You will get both of them. Are we uploading both of them today? Or are we waiting?
I'm going to do part four in a couple days.
Okay, so you guys have to wait a couple of days because I'm leaving, so I can't record. So we're going to record both and then get it to you guys on separate days. So hopefully that's fine. What?
Oh, never mind.
Okay. But in part two, we covered Sophia Silva's murder and the man who was wrongfully convicted of it. So, in part three, we are going to start with Kristen Michelle Lisk and Catherine Nicole Lisk, who went by Katie, were sisters. They were born to Patty and Ron Lisk. Patty was a nurse and Ron worked for NASA. That would be such a cool fucking job. On January 1st, 1982, their lives would be changed forever when they had a baby girl named Kristen. And then October 12th, 1984, they would welcome their second child, Katie.
Kristen and Katie were described as friendly and cheerful. They would regularly attend Gaston Baptist Church. They were both known as good students.
Kristen loved horses, everything about them. She took riding lessons at Hazelwind Farms on Thursday afternoons. Kristen was in the ninth grade. Katie would be finishing up middle school.
Katie saw the world as a place people could make a difference. She was competitive and she played on the basketball team. Katie loved to read. Her favorites were R.L. What's that supposed to say?
Steins.
Steins?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
the author of Goosebumps.
Okay. Yeah, Goosebumps. And the Fear Street Mysteries.
Oh, sorry. Too far? Okay. Patty and Ron were so proud of their two young girls. Kristen and Katie were their parents' pride and joy.
On May 1st, Kristen would leave her home to catch a ride with a close friend, Becca, to school. Katie took the bus to school that day. The day at school was just as normal as it could be. When the two arrived back home, Katie ran to her bedroom, but something wasn't quite right. She heard an unusual noise outside.
Katie went outside to go find Kristen, when instead she didn't see Kristen but saw a green Ford Taurus with the trunk open and a man standing outside. She went to go talk to the man, and when she moved closer, he grabbed her, threw her in the trunk of his car. And that's when she found her sister, in the trunk beside her. The girls tried to escape the vehicle to no avail.
Mark drove to his home in South Fork and took the sisters inside. The two were stripped naked. Katie was bound and placed in the bathroom while Kristen was restrained to his bed. He shaved her clean, just like he did with Sophia. Mark had a sexual dysfunction, which is believed to have saved the girls from being assaulted.
Mark became over his company and strangled the girls to death, where he proceeded to redress the two and place them in the trunk of his car. Mark threw the girls' body into bodies of waters. Oh my goodness. Mark threw the girls into a body of water miles away from his home.
Ron made it home.
Sorry, I scrolled too much.
Ron would always call his daughters after school to make sure they made it home okay. On May 1st, when he called and got no answer, he immediately knew something wasn't right. He called his wife, Patty, to inform her of their absence. Patty insisted that Ron needed to get home right away. Ron had planned to leave work early anyway, as Kristen had her riding lessons that afternoon.
Ron made it home around 4 p.m. that night, where he found Kristen's book bag with her schoolwork on the lawn. For other parents, this may not have been so troubling, but his children were very neat and tidy. For him, this was incredibly worrisome. Ron could not find the girls inside or outside of the home.
He knew they made it home, not only because the book bag was on the ground, but the door was unlocked and the alarm system was disabled. Ron found Katie's book bag in her room.
Ron called Patty again and informed her that something was very wrong. Patty knew he was right, even though she wanted for him to be so wrong. Ron called the neighbors asking if they had seen his children, to which they responded with no.
Ron then called his friend and explained the situation. He tried to calm Ron down by explaining that there must be an explanation. He arrived at the Lisk's home around 5 p.m. When he heard the whole story, his friend told him to make a dreadful call to 911.
The Spotsylvania Sheriff's Department put up roadblocks. They hoped that they would come across somebody who deemed suspicious. The roadblocks didn't come up with anything, but they did get a lead. They got a call that a white Ford, possibly an F-150, drove past the Lisk's house around 3 p.m.
The truck had a small camper shell with small oval windows, chrome bumper, and blue reflective strip. This truck description would match a vehicle involved in attempted abduction at Longwood College in nearby Farmville a month ago. A white male asked for directions and pulled a gun, attempting to force a female into the truck.
She screamed and ran away. The suspect sped off. Now police had a solid lead to follow. The investigators would try and track down all white Ford trucks registered in the area. They would be bummed out when they came to the realization that you did not need to state the color when registering a vehicle. This meant that officers would have to stop any white Ford truck that they came in contact with.
A massive search for the girls would be started. 1,500 people from volunteers to professionals would be searching the woods nearby. Everything within a 12-mile radius would be combed through. Search dogs would start the search at Lisk's home, but no scent would be traced. Hundreds of items would be collected, bagged, and searched during this time. They would never find anything of significance identifying the girls.
Churches all around would have signs asking to pray for the girls' safe returns. Flyers were posted all over restaurants, post offices, gas stations, etc.
Road maintenance workers from Virginia Department of Transportation were scheduled to perform a routine work on Old Ridge Road on May 6th. The crew spotted something unusual in the water. Two bodies.
They were sure that this was the sisters. The girls were transported to Richmond for an autopsy. A hair was found on Katie's sock and another on Kristen's clothing. These hairs would provide DNA to be compared to future suspects.
At 9 p.m., the media and community of Spotsylvania all stood outside the sheriff's office for an official announcement. The FBI had done a profile of the killer, which was released to the media. They had said that prior to the crime, the person may have experienced a stressful event in their life.
It could have been a problem with work, with teachers at school, managers or coworkers, maybe even with their parents or spouse. Law enforcement, maybe for some, like, less serious offense. He would have shown preoccupation with the girls for some time. He would be awkward or a lack of establishing a relationship with them. He would spend his spare time driving around the areas where young girls frequented, maybe even staring at them. He might have also shown interest in young athletic girls shown in TV shows, movies, or magazines.
In the aftermath of the crime, the suspect could have escalated his use of drugs or alcohol. He may avoid friends or family. His daily routine would show disruption. He would be highly nervous, irritable, and short-tempered. Normal sleep patterns would be disrupted. He might change his hair or his physical appearance in some sort of way. He would likely try and change the look of his vehicle. He would have unexplained scratches or bruises, and may become physically ill.
He would take a turn either towards or away from religion, and of course he would have an intense interest in the status of the investigation of the murders he committed.
The authorities had a great suspect in mind, 18-year-old Jason Talley. On the day of the girls' disappearance, he skipped school. Then about a week after their bodies were found, he cut his hair and shaved off his eyebrows.
He attended the same church as the girls, was in the same youth group, and was Kristen's age. When he took a polygraph test, he passed, and he was let go as a suspect, though the community still gave him the cold shoulder even after he was released.
On May 10th, the family had held a private funeral for the girls. They buried the two in the cemetery next to the Goshen Baptist Church. They requested, in lieu of flowers, people donated to the Kristen and Katie Lisk Memorial Trust Fund a scholarship program for public and private schools in greater Fredericksburg area, and more than $50,000 poured in from members of the community.
People started wondering if they had put the right man behind bars for the Sophia Silva case. The two cases of these young ladies had so many similarities, like the shaved areas. Authorities noticed the similarities as well and became worried.
They sent the fibers that had Carl thrown in jail in the first place to be reanalyzed by FBI. The FBI concluded that these fibers did not match as previously stated. The state lab in Richmond took the FBI's findings and reanalyzed them themselves. That's when they realized they fucked up.
They admitted their mistakes and they agreed with the FBI. All the charges that linked Carl to Sophia's case were dropped on June 16th. They still thought he might be linked, but he was put away solely on the evidence, which they did not have now. Sophia's case was now officially reopened.
The fibers did hold some leads, though. They were matched to all three girls, which meant they now had a serial killer on their hands. This also meant that Carl was in the clear, as he was behind bars when Katie and Kristen were killed.
On June 24th, 1998, 2 days after I was born, might I add, Mark and Bonnie's divorce would finally happen. Mark reached out to his father, Joe. Joe was now working for a company that designed signs for businesses, and he was also a cab driver. Mark brought up a business idea with his father, a cab business, but for big companies.
Mark would convince Joe that this was a good idea and a high-demand job. The two soon started a business together. Soon they would have to run 3 cabs just to keep up with the demand. Mark came up with what he thought was a brilliant idea, which would design improvement for tools at his previous job.
When he discussed this idea with his boss, Walter Grinders, he was not nearly as excited as Mark was about the whole thing. In fact, the opposite. Walter threatened to sue Mark on two counts. The first, stealing clients off of the client list for his cab business with his dad. The other, for ownership of Mark's invention, claiming it as their own. The threat of a lawsuit and bad money management caused a downfall that destroyed the new company, but also costed Mark his home.
The mortgage lender foreclosed his home and it was auctioned off. Mark rented a place down near Lake Anna, neighboring Louisa?
Yeah.
County for a little while struggling to get back on his feet.
Tess, Kristen, his sister, and Kristen's son Maddie went down to Virginia to visit Mark. Mark took his family out for breakfast one day where he asked the waitress out. She was hesitant, but after some time she agreed. Her name has been changed for privacy reasons, so for this story we will call her Jane.
Mark told his father how much he loved Jane. Joe wasn't too fond of her, though. He would go on to say that she was the strangest girl he had ever met. Mark's mom, Tess, and sisters Kristen and Jennifer liked her very much. Mark and Jane would be struggling financially at this point, but Kristen hopped up and offered her home for the couple to live in South Carolina. They agreed.
A few days before Christmas, Jane and Mark married. In January, Mark got a job as a director of an audit services at Armstrong Compressed Air Services. Got a job as the director. Okay, yeah. I read that right. In April, the couple moved into the Crosswoods apartment in Columbia. Oh, shit, sorry.
June 2002, Mark was feeling stressed out. His wife had multiple... Oh my God, what was this word again?
Let me just pull up the googs.
Sclerosis? That was wrong.
Sclerosis.
That was easier than I thought. Which made him overprotective. She would have dizzy spells that caused her to pass out. As we know from the past, Mark doesn't handle stress well. He put a Rubbermaid container in the backseat of his mother's 1998 green Pontiac Firebird and started driving. And that's it for part 3 of the Richard Mark Ivantes case.
Thanks for listening to the Dark Light Podcast. Follow us on Instagram at dark dark.klight.podcast_.
And on Twitter at darklightpod1. You can email us at thedarklightpodcast@hotmail.com with any episode requests, stories of yours you want to be on an upcoming sequel called Crowd Chronicles.
We will see you next Tuesday, and remember, keep your lights on!